Hello, hi, welcome to the Travel Advice Show, everybody around the world. Our website is traveladviceshow.com, and today is October 8th, 2007, and our topic today is Southern Africa, and I'm Chris Newton, and my co-host, Jerry Fuller. How you doing, Jerry?
Fantastic. How are you doing, Chris?
Oh, doing great. I'm excited about this topic, Southern Africa, and we have a great guest. Would you like to introduce our guest, Jerry?
Surely. As I mentioned before, Africa is my favorite continent in the world, and now we're going to talk about an extremely diverse area, and we're very lucky and fortunate and thrilled to have Chris Bradshaw, president of Wild Africa Safari, for our second time.
Yeah.
And Chris, welcome. We're thrilled to have you.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be on again talking about my passion, of course, which is Africa, and of course where I'm from originally as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris, for being on the show again. Yeah, thank you.
Chris, as you mentioned, we're going to be talking about Southern Africa. Would you want to define what most of the world and what we're going to talk about today is Southern Africa?
Well, yes. It is actually quite a vast area. It's the whole southern end of the continent of Africa, and what we normally term Southern Africa is south of the equator, obviously, but even a little bit further south than that, and typically encompassing countries like countries of Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, Mozambique, and of course South Africa, which is at the tip of Africa. So those are the areas that we generally regard as comprising Southern Africa, and there's an amazing diversity between all those countries, and a great destination to travel in if you're looking for variety and different things to be able to do aside from a straight safari type activity, which tends to be more what you look for when you go up into East Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I think we ought to start out with is there a better time of year to go there, to that part of the continent, or is there a worse time? And if so, why? Is there a better or worse time?
Yes. There's really not a bad time to go. I find that people enjoy it at any time. There are getting down sort of towards the southern tip of Africa. There are more distinct seasons than there tend to be in places up around the equator. But in the main, you're talking about wet and dry periods.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly the same all the way through the southern African subcontinent, but it is pretty much in the safari areas. Wet is November through to about March every year, and then you go through a cooler, drier period, which is the southern winter period, which are opposite seasons to ours here. So starting in about May, going through June, July, and August, it is cooler and drier throughout most of the subcontinent. Some people are actually quite surprised how cool to cold it can even get. I went on my honeymoon, it's quite a few years ago now, with my wife, and we went into a semi-arid area quite close to the Botswana border in Zimbabwe. And we got married June the 12th, and this honeymoon involved sleeping out in an outside treehouse. And overnight, the temperature did dip below zero Celsius, so below 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And so, you know, it took us a bit by surprise. But yes, a lot of the subcontinent is quite high above sea level. You're talking about between 4,000 and 6,000 feet above sea level, which again often surprises people. And so high temperatures are somewhat moderated.
Mm. Okay. I know, because a lot of time in the winter, you definitely need to take a sweater, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Go in the southern part.
you know, what happens is it is very much the dry season, and so the sun is pretty much shining throughout that 4 to 5 month period, starting in about April. But when you go out on a game drive in the early morning, it will be cold and you'll have to put a sweater on or a jacket. But then it warms up during the course of the day and you end up with really shorts and t-shirt weather, often in Celsius terms up in the mid-20s, which would probably be about 80, 85 degrees Fahrenheit. And then as soon as the sun sets, of course, it just dips, the temperature dips accordingly because there's no cloud cover to keep the heat in. So it's, but it is a dry season, and because of that, all of the water that does lie around during the wet season dries up, and the water holes and rivers are really the only places that animals can congregate at that time of the year to get the water that they require. Mm. And so the wildlife tends to be more concentrated during those months around what water there is. And I'm talking about along the river systems, like the Zambezi River system, in the Okavango Delta in Botswana, even in a very dry country like Namibia, you've got the Etosha National Park, which has a lot of springs along the southern border, and fantastic wildlife during the dry season. Good all year round, but definitely much better in the dry season.
Nice.
Well, let me ask this before we go any farther. If you were going to do, let me ask two questions. Number one, if you were going to do it the way you would like to do it, having been there thousands of times and lived there and are from there, if you were going to go your favorite time of year, because many North Americans only get like 2 or 3 week vacation, yes. And now would you, first of all, say, is it safe to say that certain countries are better to go a certain time of year and others are other times of year, or can you do like a circle, hit 2 or 3 countries, for example, any time of year, and why?
Yeah, I think you can really do most times of the year, and you can definitely stay within a 2 week period. I do urge people that, you know, whilst the inclination is to try and see as much as you can in a short amount of time, we do find that people do like it a little bit more quietly paced. And so within a 2 week period, I would say really 2, maybe 3 countries, definitely no more than that. You know, it depends a lot on people's budgets and the times of the year that they can travel themselves. Obviously, people with families tend to be able to travel more in our summer than any other period. Prices do go up in the dry season there. So again, the June, July, August, September into October time, prices generally go up in the safari areas. But at the other end of the scale, they go down in places like Cape Town, which actually has quite a Mediterranean climate. So it has hot, dry summers and then cool, wet winters. So it's the only area within Southern Africa that you possibly could get rain during their winter, again, the June, July, August period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, communications as far as flights and things between the places is concerned, excuse me, it's very, very easy to do. It is quite possible to say, start off in Cape Town, finish in Cape Town, beautiful city, definitely worthwhile visiting, the site of the earliest European settlements in that part of Africa dating back to the 1650s. So a lot of history and wineries and since the New South Africa in 1994, a lot of wonderful cultural activities and things like that there. Mm-hmm. So you could start there and then possibly, depending on your interest, you could go up into Namibia, which is a fantastic desert country. the Namib Desert there is a true desert, and parts of it have never seen recorded rain. So it is a fantastic destination. Parts of it have these most amazing dunes, some of the highest in the world, and great sunsets and wonderful hiking up these dunes. I was there with my family, who were young teenagers at the time, a couple of years ago, and they still rate Namibia as one of their favorite destinations because of the variety and the desert scenery, which they really enjoyed. And then you could possibly also go in Namibia up into the Ongava, Etosha area, and stay at a game lodge there. And then from Windhoek, which is the capital of Namibia, you could fly across into Botswana and visit the game lodges in the unique Okavango Delta. And when I say unique, it is really unique because it's a river that deltas not into a lake or into the sea, but it actually deltas into the Kalahari Desert. And there's water there all the year round, but it disappears literally into the Kalahari sands. But it is a fantastic game viewing destination. So you could include that, and then possibly even do Victoria Falls before heading back to Cape Town or Johannesburg to fly home. Mm-hmm. So you can have a tremendous amount of variety in that. You can have a beautiful old city like Cape Town, sea, beaches, and then go up into the desert areas of Namibia, game viewing in Botswana, and ending off with the magnificent Victoria Falls, where there are huge numbers of adventure-type activities that you can do, from bungee jumping to elephant back safaris. A wonderful...
You can go whitewater rafting down the Zambezi, which I've done several times.
Oh, yes. Well, that's also something. The Zambezi River itself, which is where Victoria Falls is situated, below the Kariba Dam, which is forms the northern border between Zimbabwe and Zambia, the stretch of river of about 250 kilometers from the dam at Kariba to the border with Mozambique, you have this pristine river system where you can actually go canoeing along the Zambezi River, just a 4 or 5 Canadian style canoes with a guide, camping on the banks of the river. Really, Jerry, you say you've done it. It truly is a magnificent thing to do, and anybody can do it. My wife is not particularly enthusiastic about really wild areas, but she would go on a canoe safari again at the drop of a hat. It was just such an amazing experience for her.
And the animals and wildlife that you see is phenomenal.
The wildlife, yes, absolutely, because particularly again in the dry season, all the animals have moved from the areas inland closer to the river so that they can actually have water nearby during the dry season. So, yes, elephants by the hundreds, buffalo, all of the what we call the plains game, the antelopes. The only thing you don't see in that stretch of the river are giraffes, because it is a valley, and actually the giraffes have never made it down the sides of the valley into the valley floor. So, in fact, there aren't giraffes there, but there are plenty of giraffes in most other areas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, not only below the Zambezi, below the Kariba Dam wall, you do have the upper Zambezi above Victoria Falls, where it's not quite as far a distance, but you can also do a 1 or 2 day canoeing trip along the Zambezi above Victoria Falls. And again, the wildlife that you see, elephants crossing the river from one side to the other, their little areas of rapids, and hippos, of course, are a constant concern, but with a professional guide, you really have a fantastic experience with these cautions about things like hippos, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of walking type activities that you can do in a lot of these areas, and a country like Zambia is slowly but surely opening up. It has a fantastic network of national parks and game reserves. Wilderness Safaris, who's a world-renowned company that specializes in camps and lodges in pristine wilderness areas. They've opened up camps in a park called Kafue National Park, which is north of the Victoria Falls. And their areas there, the Basanga Plains, are very like the Serengeti, you know, wide open grass plains, fantastic for the wildlife, the plains animals, so the antelopes, but then also the predators that prey on them, like the lions, and it's a fantastic area for things like cheetahs, which like the wide open plains to be able to run their prey down. Mm-hmm. So you've got that side of it as well. Walking, you can do canoeing, you can go on elephant back safaris, you can in some areas you can do not in the, a lot of the true wilderness areas, but there are certain areas where you can go on bikes, you can actually cycle through some of these areas. Really, you name it, there are just so many things that you can do, and in a relatively short safari, you can include all these wonderful activities and get your adrenaline fill while you're doing so.
That's
I know. While we're talking about going between areas, one thing that is becoming popular, and would you give your opinion on it and pros and cons and what areas you might do it, are what are called the air safaris. Do you recommend them? And if so, are there areas better for it or anything like that? Would you want to give us?
If you're talking about a flying safari, basically,
right.
Flying from area to area.
Right. Do you recommend that?
Yes, it's... I certainly do.
By that, I mean, again, a charter plane.
The small light aircraft. A lot of these camps are in very wild areas, and roads are non-existent. I'm talking about places like the Okavango Delta, where at certain times of the year it is flooded, and so there, you know, it is very difficult to get in there by road anyway. Even if there was a road, in which case, in many cases, there aren't even roads.
Mm-hmm.
So by flying into these areas, you're actually getting to your lodge or your camp very, very quickly, and then you're based at your camp, maximizing the amount of time that you can spend in that camp and doing all the activities that are there. So when you're talking about a limited amount of time to do a safari, and North Americans do generally have that limited amount of time, you know, this is definitely one way that you can maximize the time that you spend traveling between places and actually spending productive time on the ground doing the safari activities that you've come to do.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the countries that I've been talking about, Namibia, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe to a limited extent, and parts of South Africa have a very, very good system of air safaris into their wildlife and scenic areas. And I do certainly recommend it. Price-wise, yes, it can certainly add a bit on to the price, but it is certainly worth it in my mind. You're there quickly, safely, and then you're free to relax and enjoy yourself.
And it certainly gives a different perspective as you're flying over these areas and countries, and a lot of times you'll fly over the park, and
yeah.
the, the reserve area so that you can really get an aerial view before you get down there and start to land explore.
Exactly. Yes, I was going to mention that. That's a good point. You know, flying over something like the Okavango Delta, when you're actually on the ground, you don't get quite an appreciation of what this unique ecosystem is like. But from above in an aircraft, you can see, you know, the tendrils, as it were, of the delta, snaking their way through these little islands. You can see wildlife. Another unique area to fly over is the Namib Desert in Namibia, where you know, you get, again, that completely different perspective as far as the eye can see, these huge sand dunes. And it's actually amazing in certain areas with the rise and fall of the ocean level.
Right.
You've got shipwrecks and things. The Skeleton Coast, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, is in Namibia. And you get the skeletons of these vessels, which are now several kilometers inland from the sea, and it's just been the sand movement and the sea level dropping, and suddenly these boats are high and dry in the middle of the desert, and you wonder how on earth they got there. So, you know, you really do get a fantastic perspective of it when you're flying over it. The Victoria Falls to fly over is amazing, because you can really only appreciate the grandeur and the scale of the Victoria Falls from the air. You know, you can walk along the banks and look in and get, you know, the spray on you from the falls. But, you know, when you're above it, you can actually see that tremendous amount of water coming down the river and seeing it just drop over the lip of the falls themselves. It is a fantastic sight. And that, in fact, in that area is called the Flight of Angels. The sightseeing flights over the falls are called Flight of Angels, and that's comes from David Livingstone, who was the first European to see the falls in the 1850s. He, normally very dour, he wrote in his diary that sights such as these must have been gazed on by angels in their flight. So now any people flying over it are actually doing that Flight of Angels over the falls. So it's actually quite an apt description of it.
I know it. So I want to talk just a little bit, as you're talking about transportation and unique transportation. There are two things that I think we do need to cover, because they're so fabulous in this part of the world for certain clients and people visiting. One of them, of course, is the private rail, which is the Blue Train, not really private, but the Blue Train. I guess it is private, isn't it? I don't know. I've been on about 6 or 7 times. I don't know if it's private or not, and Rovis Rail. And then I think we ought to talk about overlanding, particularly in the western part, like maybe starting in Cape Town, as you mentioned, and overlanding up from the western part of South Africa into Namibia, Botswana, and into Zambia. Do you want to talk about those two options? Because they're absolutely fabulous.
Yes, they certainly are, and they're quite different ends of the spectrum, of course. I'll start with the luxury trains like the Blue Train and Rovis Rail, and there are some sort of in the in between that, and then I'll go on to the overland, which is more the budget kind of trip. Not for everybody, but certainly more and more people are interested in the overland option. But let's talk a little bit about the trains. The Blue Train has been going, you know, for many, many years. I think probably 70 or more years.
Right.
It was introduced in South Africa as the means of transport between Johannesburg or Pretoria, particularly, and Cape Town. And it was introduced mainly because they have a system of different capitals within South Africa, which they actually still do. Pretoria was the administrative capital. Cape Town was the legislative capital, so that's where the parliament was. And then Bloemfontein in the Orange Free State was the judicial capital. And so the legislators would travel backwards and forwards from Pretoria, the administrative capital, to the parliamentary capital being Cape Town. And so that's where the Blue Train originated from, was to get a luxury option for, you know, the parliamentarians to actually travel between those two places. Of course, it's now completely different, and it is a very, very modern, still blue. It is actually painted blue, but very, very luxurious journey from Pretoria to Cape Town or the other way around. And the Blue Train does do periodic trips also in other parts of Southern Africa, but the main run that it does is a 24-hour journey from Pretoria to Cape Town or Cape Town back to Pretoria again. It's really, really five-star, top-notch food. The cuisine is wonderful. The wine lists of wonderful South African wines are extensive. The accommodations are very luxurious now, and it certainly is a fantastic experience. It's also timed so that it does go through some of the more interesting areas during daylight hours, so that you can get a perspective of things like the Cape Winelands during the daylight hours. And then overnight, it's actually traveling through the semi-arid, desert-like area of the Peru in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Robert Vale is owned by the Vos family, so Rohan Vos is the Ro and Vos of Robos Travel.
Mm-hmm.
He had an idea maybe 20 years ago now that he wanted to introduce an alternative to the Blue Train, aimed more at the tourist, and he also had a fascination with antique trains, so rolling stock and engines, particularly steam engines, that were being phased out, and he wanted to rehabilitate those, bring back the compartments and carriages to their former glory from the 20s and 30s, and have an Orient Express, as for want of a better description, a kind of an Orient Express kind of journey, but in South Africa. And he's been tremendously successful with this, and Rovos Rail is well known all over the world, and deservedly so. They have a fantastic variety of different trips that they do, some of which not very much of which is still by steam, but wherever possible, they do still put a steam engine on, so you get that real romantic feel of the travel in the 20s and 30s. They go also between Cape Town and Pretoria. Pretoria is...
They take longer to do that, don't they? They take about a day longer to do that.
Yes, indeed. In fact, it's two-night journey as opposed to... Yeah. A one-night journey, and they do actually stop in various places at night so that you're get a restful night's sleep and not, you know, you're put off in a siding somewhere so that you can actually get a good night's sleep, but also that the timing is correct so that you're going through the interesting areas. And they do stop on that journey from Pretoria to Cape Town or the other way around. They do stop in two places. They stop in Kimberley, which is the famous place where diamonds were discovered in South Africa in the 1870s, I think, 70s and 80s. There's a fantastic museum there, which they visit. And then they also go down to a very unique Victorian town on the edge of the Karoo, the desert area there, called Mikey's Fontaine. Which is very much as it was from the Victorian times. The buildings and things are very much as they were, and it was has been used over the years for various different purposes. But its last sort of famous purpose was that it was a hospital town for wounded soldiers fighting in the Anglo-Boer War, which is at the turn of the 19th, 20th centuries.
Mm.
So that's one of the only one of the journeys that they do. Rovers Rail also does a trip up through Zimbabwe into Victoria Falls. That's a very, very popular route to be done there. They also do a trip into Namibia, and their once-a-year trip, they do right up through the whole Southern African area from Pretoria up through Victoria Falls, through Zambia, up to Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. That is a highly sought after route. It's sold out normally very, very early. I think you'll probably find that July next year is, if not already sold out, must be pretty close. So they have that once a year, and what they've done with that is to also extend it with an optional add-on where you go in one of Rovers Rail's vintage aircraft, and I use that term advisedly. This is an old DC-6, which has been renovated again to full safety standards, luxuriously equipped, and they then are taking you right up to Cairo. So the famous old Cape to Cairo route that you used to do by rail and air, going again back to the 20s and 30s, has now been recreated by Rovers Rail. So that's another fantastic journey that that they're offering in both directions, from Cairo through Dar es Salaam back to Cape Town, or from Cape Town all the way through Dar es Salaam and up to Cairo. So you're mixing that fantastic mix of wildlife and culture in southern and central Africa, going right up to the ancient civilizations of Egypt. So really fantastic trip that you can do. Then you get the other end of the spectrum, and I'll finish with trains, but I'll mention also you do have a number of other smaller trains. There's one called Shongololo, which is almost like a cruise but by rail. So you go on a trip through Southern Africa. You have your compartment like you might on a cruise for, you know, a 14 to 20 day period. I think they have them going up to about 3 weeks in length. So you can unpack like you can do on a cruise, and then the train goes from interesting place to interesting place. You sleep on board the train, obviously, but they also carry vehicles on the train which, when you get to an interesting stop, they unload off the train, and you go touring in those interesting areas. So
just like a short excursion.
They do daily excursions in different places, and then generally it'll travel overnight to get you to another interesting area. So, you know, in South Africa, it'll go right along the famous garden route. It'll go up into the Kruger National Park area. And each place that you go to, you'll get out in the vehicles and actually go and see the interesting sites in those areas. And it's much more budget option than any of these, than Rovers and the Blue Train. But the food on board is excellent, the accommodations are very, very good. There are shared bathroom facilities, but you do have a little basin in your compartment. You know, it's certainly something that would appeal to people that don't like to be packing and repacking too often and like the idea of traveling by rail through Southern Africa. So that's called Shongololo, which is actually named after a millipede, which is located in Shongololo in that area. Yeah. So to get onto the overlanding options, we definitely have a huge variety of those, and they do extend from the very budget participation camping, where you help set up your camp, travel in a big vehicle, set up your camp, go out into the local markets, negotiate and buy your food, possibly assist with the cooking of it. You go right from that to other higher-end overlands where your tent is set up for you, you know, the food is prepared, your bed is made up for you, all of those kind of things, but you are still traveling around by road wherever possible. Some of them do combine a little bit of flying as well, but most of the budget overlands are literally that. They start in often in places like Nairobi and then go right down through Tanzania, Malawi, Zambia. Victoria Falls is the hub often, so some of them end there, others start there, and then continue on through Botswana or Namibia into South Africa, and ultimately a lot of them end up in Cape Town. So you can do trips of up to 50, 60 days if you have the time, at a very modest amount of money. You're talking often on a daily basis, with all your food and activities and obviously all your transport, at maybe $50 to $60 a day, which really isn't bad at all, considering that you don't have to put your hand in your pocket for too much else.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I know. So, one time, I've never done the overlanding from the southern part, but I did a 12-week trip from London to Mombasa one time overlanding.
Oh, did you?
Back in the old days. Yes, in the 60s. And I tell you, it was overlanding. We even had to push ourselves out of the mud and through rivers all the time.
Yeah.
But when you're young, it's fabulous. And I really recommend overlanding to the person who truly wants to have an experience of a lifetime. It's kind of scary in a way because you can get little amoebas and little things like that if you're not really, really careful. But it's worth it. And the guides are wonderful. They boil the water and everything's pretty safe. But it's a fabulous experience. I just love it.
It is certainly. My son, who was 18 at the time, did an overland from Nairobi from Johannesburg to Nairobi. He rated it very, very highly. He made some good friends. He still communicates with people, and that's the whole thing about it. It does bring people from all sorts of different parts of the world together, like-minded young people. Mainly, although a lot of older people are joining these trips now as well. He met people from Austria, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa itself, the UK, Ireland, Canada, the United States, all traveling together on an overland vehicle and, you know, experiencing these wonderful sights and wildlife and things together. And that's part of the appeal for a lot of people is that they can share it with like-minded people whilst, you know, not paying an absolute fortune for the experience.
Yeah.
I know. That 12-week cost me under $600 in the 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, it was unreal. And that was in the 60s. Now they're a bit more than that, but they're really very, as you say, they're very inexpensive for what you get, and it's wonderful, wonderful experience for the right person. Before we go too much farther, we need to spend a little bit of time on the different kinds of national parks and areas where you can view game, because that's one of the major reasons people go to Southern Africa. But we don't want to spend hours on it, because we could spend hours on the different kinds of. But could you talk some about maybe some specifics in some of the countries, but generally about the kinds of lodges, tent camps, the different kinds of available things that people can stay in, and why they would go to a private game park versus a national like Kruger versus Sabi Sabi or something like that, Sabi Sands, and why they would do either and that kind of a thing. Are there some places they really should visit, particularly if they go a particular time of year, and is it worth the money to stay in some of the magnificent ones that they have and go in that way and spend a bit of time on that? Because that's a real fabulous part of Southern Africa.
Yes. Well, most of the countries in Southern Africa, particularly places like Botswana, are very well endowed with national parks and wildlife reserves. South Africa as well, although Mostly that's up in the northern part of South Africa. Namibia has a large number of national parks as well as Zambia. Certainly they will provide a focus for most people. There will be names that they will have heard, like Kruger National Park in South Africa, a very famous name, which they've obviously chosen to leave as Kruger National Park because it is so well known around the world and they don't want to get it confused. Starting with Kruger National Park, it is one of the oldest national parks in Africa, comprises a huge, huge area in the northeastern part of South Africa. That is a national park, and within the national park, there are large numbers of rest camps, what are termed rest camps, which are basically accommodation camps where people can self-drive in and stay at a relatively small amount of money, generally on a self-catering basis, or most of the camps have restaurants, and so people can go into those to eat if they don't particularly want to self-cater for themselves. Disadvantage, if I can say, of a national park like Kruger is that, of course, it is open to everybody. They have a policy, which is quite correct, in that you stay in your vehicle on the roads. There's no off-road driving at all. If you're in your own vehicle or you're in a rented vehicle, you have to stick to the roads. You could be seeing wildlife with dozens of other people, and unfortunately that does occur from time to time. You know, if there's a lion kill or something on the side of the road, there will obviously be a lot of people sitting watching it, and vehicles can be jostling, and animals can sometimes be disturbed. There's no question about it, it can be a little unpleasant. Don't get me wrong. Kruger National Park is absolutely fabulous, but
But we shouldn't. We need to mention also they could have busloads of people.
Well, yes,
that's
true. Right.
And
we
not
do
just
have
carloads,
quite
but
large,
busloads.
Yeah,
right.
Large vehicles going through.
Mm-hmm.
So your option, if you want to go into the Kruger National Park area, is to perhaps look at the private reserves, which actually form the border, mostly on the western border of the Kruger National Park. You have a large number of private game reserves. Now, these are in wildlife reserves, but they are private areas. So they are originally hunting areas that have been converted to wildlife preservation areas. Some of them have been in families for generations, and they've been turned into wildlife reserves. And the wonderful thing with Kruger National Park a few years ago, they took all the fences down from the western side of the Kruger National Park where all these private reserves are. And so the wildlife moves freely between the private and the park itself. Mm. But when you're in a private reserve, you're there with limited numbers of people. You're only there in vehicles that are owned or run by the private game reserve itself. Because they're private land, they don't have to follow quite as closely the rules and regulations, as it were, about off-road. In fact, they do encourage their guides to get their clients close up to the wildlife, so you can see a lion kill off in the distance and actually get closer to it. And it's done very, very well, and the animals themselves are not disturbed, but you do get fantastic sightings that way instead of a long-distance view possibly from a vehicle or a bus in the Kruger National Park itself. The other thing about the camps and lodges in those areas, and I'm talking generally throughout Southern Africa, although some of the lodges in South Africa are a bit larger than others, they tend to be quite small. In Botswana, some of your camps, and when I talk about camps and lodges, they're often fairly freely interchanged. Camps tend to be more a a tented type accommodation, but this is fixed tents. So your walls are canvas, but you still have your bathroom en suite. They're beautifully decorated, but your walls are canvas, and you're getting that unique African experience of being able to hear the wildlife at night through the safety. And I do reassure people that it is very, very safe. I've never heard of any particular problem with people staying in these fixed tents in some of the camps throughout southern Africa. But you're staying in that camp, you're there with those people, you've got professional driver guides taking you out. These are resident at the various lodges or camps, and they know the area intimately. They know where you're going to get possibly a good sighting of an elephant herd at a particular time during the day. They know where the birds are nesting during the breeding season. You know, they know the area intimately, and they're very, very good raconteurs. And that, to me, is one of the real highlights of Southern Africa, is the standard of guiding is way, way more than it is in most other parts of Africa. Mm-hmm. They know the trees, they know the uses of the bark, they know, you know, in tribal culture, this particular branch of this tree can be made into a sort of bush toothbrush. And they'll demonstrate how it can actually be used to clean your teeth. You know, it's fascinating what those guides will give you, and particularly in the private game reserves scattered around South Africa and Southern Africa generally. You know, in places like the Okavango Delta, the Murami Game Reserve forms part of the Okavango Delta. There, the Botswana government has a specific high-cost, low-impact tourism policy. Now, you know, that's sad for some people because the costs are quite high in Botswana, but it does give you a totally exclusive experience. A lot of the camps there are only four or five units, so maybe, you know, six or eight people in a particular camp with the staff, with your guide. You know, what better can that be? And in this huge game reserve that only you are in, you know, people are prepared to pay for that experience.
Yeah, it's really important, and a lot of people don't realize it when they go to that part of the world, that the best experience often does cost more, but they don't realize the variety and the options they have in accommodations and areas. And it's really important to talk to people like you that know that, because it makes the whole difference of a fabulous, wonderful trip and just a good trip.
Yes, yes. No, I agree. The guide and the guiding, you know, people have often said to me, you know, 10 years down the road, and you know, I've joked with them because they came to me 10 years ago and said, you know, we want to have a really good trip to Africa. This is going to be the only time we ever go to Africa. Let's make it good. They include a lot of different areas, and away they go, and they have a fantastic time. And then, you know, they love it so much that they go back again 2 years after that and 2 years after that. So I've had people, you know, traveling five or six times in 10 years because they've really enjoyed it so much. But they all say to me that, and I would back it up wholeheartedly, that, you know, you don't remember how fancy the furnishings were necessarily at a particular lodge. What you remember are your guides, your wildlife, and the actual experience that you have there. So, you know, some of the lodges and camps are truly luxurious, and people like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's often not what they're remembering about a place. It is the ambience, the feel, the total experience of being in Africa with a professional who knows what they're talking about, and seeing, you know, this amazing wildlife, which really, you know, can't be beaten. It's just an incredible experience, and it draws you back over and over and over again. Without question, leave a part of you behind often in Africa, and you kind of have to go back again. It just,
I know. In fact, you also take a lot of it with you, don't you? You're never the same again when you've gone to Africa. That's what's my favorite continent in the world.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, people go again and again because even as we've described here within Southern Africa, they can have a totally different experience in South Africa to what they'd have in Botswana, and totally different again in Namibia to what they would have in Zambia. So it, you know, the variety, and people go back, and I do say, though, that we eventually find that people who've gone back three or four times, they often narrow in on a particular place that really has stolen their heart, and you know, they go back there. They may include a few other places, but they always go back to that same place or that same area. So it's I talk to people all the time, and everybody says, oh boy, it's really some place that I've always wanted to go to, and you know, all I've got to say is that, you know, you've got to do it now, really. Who knows, global warming, who knows what's going to happen in the world. Really, now is the time to go and see a lot of these places, and just experience what the wild can be like.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that we need to talk about, because I've been to it six or seven times, just some scuba diving off of the top northern part of it, but I know a place that's emerging in Mozambique. Can we talk about Mozambique just a bit?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It was certainly something that I did intend to mention. Mozambique, yes, a former Portuguese colony, went through 20 years of civil war, which really only ended in the 90s, in the 1990s. Since then, they've had a very, very stable government and a huge growth in tourist potential. The potential was always there, but the realization of a lot of that potential is starting to happen now. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to see a beautiful coastline. You've got places like the Bazaruta Archipelago, which is off the coast. It's a series of smaller islands. Most of which have a small little beach resort on them. Again, small, not your huge, 100-room resorts that you might find in parts of the Caribbean and things like that. It's it is still small, very unique, and a wonderful combination with somewhere like the Kruger National Park. It's actually closer to get from the Kruger National Park to the Bazaruta Archipelago than it is to get to most parts of South Africa. So, you know, it is actually very close to it as well. And you've got fantastic things happening now between Zimbabwe, South Africa, and Mozambique around the Kruger National Park. The Mozambicans have established the Limpopo National Park, which is on the border of Kruger National Park, so it's on the Mozambique side. But they're looking at, down the road, taking away the fences that were on that border so that the wildlife completely flows between those areas. This is all traditional area that this wildlife would have gone through anyway in generations past. And then up in Zimbabwe, the Gonaruzu National Park is also being included in that. So you're going to have this huge transfrontier national park, which will be huge, absolutely huge, amongst the biggest in Africa, and going to be easily accessible from both Mozambique, or all of them, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and South Africa. So you can combine that beach and bush kind of thing where you can go along to have a fantastic wildlife safari and then relax for a few days on the beach somewhere. Mm-hmm. I can certainly recommend it. We've had a lot of families particularly doing that, and it's nice for families because, families generally do enjoy a beach-type destination, particularly some of the younger kids. And so they can get their fill of both the animals and the beach over that period, you know, during the time that they're traveling. Further north up in Mozambique, there's a lot of colonial Portuguese-type history. The Portuguese first explored these areas in the 1490s, so, you know, it dates back almost as long as explorations into the Americas started. And so you have old Portuguese forts, old towns on some of the islands closer up to the Tanzanian border. Some of those are all opening up now as well. The links by air from South Africa and other parts of Mozambique are slowly but surely coming on. So you've got a really, really wonderful destination coming on, as I say, with the opening up of things like the Limpopo National Park, the famous old Gorongosa National Park is being rehabilitated, and the terrible landmines and things that were planted in there are slowly but surely being eradicated. So it is definitely opening up, and I for one, am really excited and hope that it happens, you know, at an orderly pace, but that it, you know, it continues to happen, because I really think that it is going to be a real jewel in the crown of that area.
I know. I have been going to Mozambique since the mid-60s and have seen a huge change in it from being a wonderful country to being practically a desolated country, desecrated country, too. And
yes.
Then now I'm ecstatic that it's starting to come back. And
yes.
It's a beautiful place and a wide variety of things to do, and the history and the architecture and the food. The food's different there, too.
Yes.
And it's really a neat place.
Yes, it is. You know, that was always our family beach destination when I was growing up in Zimbabwe. The port town of Beira in Mozambique was our destination. And again, slowly but surely, the areas around Beira are rehabilitating and opening up again. You know, I just am happy that it is happening, definitely. You know, of course, you can get that kind of experience in other places up in East Africa as well as even in parts of South Africa. But it still has a different feel about it. That's the appeal of southern Africa, is that you know, again, and you can beat up on colonial influences as much as you like, but it's amazing how some of those influences are still very, very much evident there. You know, in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, which was the former Lourenco Marques when it was a Portuguese colony, very much like continental Portugal, the way that the streets are laid out and the squares and things like that, it has a real European feel about it. Places like Namibia, that was German Southwest Africa before the First World War, some of the buildings in Windhoek and Swakopmund on the coast are designed in the old German architectural style, with very steep roofs so that the snow would be able to melt off them. You know, that's how they knew how to build a building, and so they built it in Africa, where there wasn't the hope and, you know, of any snow ever falling there. But you know, it's just those little interesting things that you often come across, and it stops and makes you think about history and what that area has been through over the years. You know, a lot of it's positive, a lot of it's negative, but it's part of the culture of that part of the world now, and not much can be done to change that, really.
Mm-hmm. And I hope it never does change, because that's one of the things that makes it so unique. And
exactly.
it gives it a unique character. There's no place in the world like Southern Africa, and everybody that goes there absolutely loves it. And as you said, I have some favorite spots, and I know you have favorite spots, but all of it, well, 99% of it, is fascinating, and everyone should go to as much as possible.
Yes.
So, Chris,
yeah.
We talked about everything about Southern Africa.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
We don't want to keep you all night, but this has been fabulous.
Yeah.
We're going to have you back again.
Yes.
And we'll do other things on it, because this has been truly enlightening, and I know our listeners are ecstatic. And don't forget, it's wildafricasafaris.com. And this is Chris Bradshaw that we have as our guest, and he's the president of it. And they do wonderful trips. They did my trip. They even did my trip to Kilimanjaro last year. And Chris knows what he's doing. And I want to tell you, Chris, your prices, everyone that we've done through travel advice to you, everyone is stunned. Fabulous quality and the extremely reasonable fair prices that you're charging compared to other competition. And you're a phenomenal company. And so we're thrilled to have you as our guest.
Well, it's been a delight, and I'm sorry I've talked so much, but it is a passion of mine, as you can probably gather. And I just love to be able to introduce people to that part of the world, because really it has so much to offer, and we haven't even really scratched the surface. So I'd be very happy to talk to anybody who ever wants to know anything more about it.
Great.
And just a little quick, you mentioned our website, that's it's actually wildafricasafari.com.
Oh, that's right. No, that's right.
And www.wildafricasafari.com. And certainly get hold of us through the website, and there is a toll-free number for North American callers listed on the website.